This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
As reported last week on KBOO News, the pro fluoride group Healthy Kids, Healthy Portland recruited local not-for-profits to support the fluoride measure. This local support often contradicts national organizations and figures advocating for the same group. Ambassador Andrew Young and the Reverend Dr. Bernice King oppose fluoridation, while Portland's Urban League supports the measure. The Portland Latino Network signed on to fluoridation, while the League of United Latin American Citizens strongly opposes fluoridation. I spoke with Henry Rodriguez of LULAC. I asked him about the efforts to fluoridate his hometown of San Antonio.
And then I felt so bad the third time around when I saw the powers that be pour tons of money into their propaganda to fluoridate the water. And that, you know, it really raised a red flag. I took it all the way to the national convention in 2 years ago in Cincinnati, Ohio. And before a full delegation, the assembly there, about 1,500, I would say, delegates, and it passed unanimously. After a while, some people started having second thoughts of what they had done, but we prevailed on that one. There was talk about rescinding the resolution the very next year, but it did not happen because after that, we started working on it, and some people became aware, and they got on our side, actively. Throughout the LULAC country.
It sounds like ideas were represented on both sides. Were there any benefits that were generally agreed upon as far as fluoridating the water?
That we agreed on? No. No, there was nobody that came up and said, yeah, it's good for you. Until after my resolution, then some people did call from LULAC, from other parts of the country, and saying, what are you doing? Don't you know that this is something beneficial for our kids and this and that? And I said, I challenge you to challenge me at the next convention. And they did not.
What scientific evidence would you say really convinced you?
Now let me tell you on that one. When it comes to the scientific evidence, I stay away from that because of that opens up me up for people calling me a conspiracy theorist. What I said in my resolution, that it was a civil rights violation, and that the Center for Disease Control is saying that it's not a good idea to give babies fluoridated water in the formula. I mean, that in itself says volumes. Yeah, that's the scientific part that I have, when it comes to that. Of course, I have studied it, but then again, I'm not an authority. But what I know is that it is a civil rights violation. It is forced medication. You cannot, one size does not fit all. Some people drink more water than others, like the athletes and laborers and people that are diabetic versus some other people that don't drink as much water. And besides, the mothers have to use bottled water, and not everybody has money to buy bottled water for their baby's formula.
I don't know if you're following the local issue here in Portland. We're going up for a ballot measure on whether to fluoridate our water. One of the remarkable things was the list of local not-for-profits serving low-income and minority groups that came out for it.
Yes, I know. That's a big push, but I think it's big-time propaganda, and people have in the past worked on our minority areas. And really, pretty much shoved it down their throats. On 2002, the latest, our communities, the minority communities, overwhelmingly defeated it. We have 10 districts. And one district, 1 through 6, they rejected it. It was those upscale districts that turned out big-time voters that did us in.
All right. Well, Portlanders will get their ballots in a couple of weeks. Any advice to voters in Portland?
If your water is clean, and really, look at see if there's any real problem, then why would you jeopardize your water, your beautiful, great water that you have there in Portland? I mean, vote against it and then do your research. And if they want to bring it back up again, you will be even more ready, if you will, to confront those issues. Believe me, if you prevail right now, they're going to come back again, like they did here in San Antonio. We defeated them twice, resoundingly. But they come back and spend over almost $1 million. And you can, it's a way of life in this country or in other countries where in politics, money talks. and those are the people that have the most influence, the one with the deeper pockets. And that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
That was Henry Rodriguez of the League of United Latin American Citizens. Nationally, LULAC opposes fluoridation. In his hometown of San Antonio, Latino groups overwhelmingly voted no on fluoridation, while Better Off groups supported the measure. Since San Antonio started fluoridation in 2002, no improvements in dental health are reported. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
A Gresham police officer fired for drunk driving has sued the city for $6 million, according to the Associated Press. The officer, Jason Servo, claims he suffers from alcoholism, a disability recognized under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and should not have been fired. He further claims that his police union failed to represent him adequately. Servo, the department's lead firearm instructor, drove an unmarked police vehicle to firearms training in Troutdale in January 2011, then joined fellow officers for dinner and drinks. The officer was arrested later that evening after he crashed the vehicle in a ditch. Servo pled guilty to drunken driving and entered a diversion program. After he fulfilled the program's requirements, the DUI was dismissed. He then entered an inpatient program at a drug and alcohol treatment center and was diagnosed as an alcoholic. The lawsuit claims the chief of Gresham Police fired Servo to save money, citing a funding issue in the police department.
U.S. District Judge Gar M. King this week rejected defense motions to order a new trial or to acquit Mohamed Mohamed. Mohamed, a Somali-American, was convicted earlier this year of attempting to bomb a 2011 tree lighting ceremony in Portland's Pioneer Square. King found against defense arguments that the government did not provide enough evidence to prove that it did not entrap Mohamed. King also ruled against the defense on 3 points likely to be raised on appeal after Mohammed's June 17th sentencing. On each point, King wrote in his opinion that the concerns were not vital to the defense and had not created a context that hindered their defense.
In 2010, Columbia County Jails instituted a policy that limited prisoners' mail privileges to the sending and receiving of postcards. Last year, an injunction from U.S. District Court Judge Michael Simon ended the policy, citing violation of the First Amendment rights of prisoners and of the people who write to them. The ruling made public yesterday calls into question restrictions on prisoners' rights to mail throughout the country. KBOO's Evan Owen Stively spoke with Alex Friedman of the Human Rights Defense Center for more perspective on the ruling.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the practice of restricting incoming mail to postcards nationally and in Oregon itself.
It is a developing practice where a number of jails nationwide, not just in Oregon, but Colorado, Tennessee, Florida, various other states, California, have enacted a policy that either restricts prisoners from receiving any mail except for postcards and or sending any mail except for postcards. Started in Maricopa County, Arizona in 2007 and has expanded since then and has been the subject of a number of different court challenges in various states.
The explanation for that policy in general is that it's a mechanism for preventing contraband from circulating through the mail system. Is that correct?
That is one of the arguments that they use in an attempt to justify it, yes. And the other is that it saves time because the mailroom doesn't have to go through the mail, basically. People are only sending postcards.
Judge Simon ruled that Columbia County did not have such justification. Is that correct? That was part of his argument?
That's correct. I mean, once you actually look at the evidence indicates that in this case, those were pretextual justifications. The head jail staff testified that in over a decade of running the jail and processing mail, that they only had maybe one, possibly two cases where contraband came in the mail, which they found because they were inspecting the mail. They also heard testimony from jail staff who verified that the amount of time saved in processing the mail was minimal because the amount of time to open an envelope and shake it out and make sure there's no guns or drugs or knives inside was minimal.
I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of background on the Turner versus Safley test, which addresses whether or not restrictions on prisoners violate the First Amendment or not.
Well, Turner versus Safley is a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1987, and it doesn't only apply to First Amendment cases. It basically applies to all prison conditions cases, which encompasses First Amendment issues in some cases. And it sets forth a four-part test as to whether a prison regulation is constitutional or will be upheld by the court. And some of the parts of that four-part test include primarily whether the regulation is reasonably related to a legitimate penological objective or reason. In this case, the court found that there was not a rational justification. There's not that nexus between the postcard-only policy of the jail and the reasons that jail staff put forward as the rationale for that policy. This is the first time that a federal court has issued a ruling on the merits as to whether a postcard-only policy, which restricts not only the right of inmates held at jails, who, incidentally, are mostly pretrial detainees. They're held pending trial, not yet convicted, and therefore innocent until proven guilty. But their family members outside of prison, attorneys, publishers like ourselves, we also have First Amendment rights independent of those in jail to contact people who are held in jail. So the ruling is the first time that a federal court has held on the merits that this kind of policy is unconstitutional and should be struck down. And we're hoping that other jails around the nation learn from it, basically, learn from this ruling, and take a second look at their policies that restrict the First Amendment rights, not only of prisoners, but those who write to them. We are a very litigious organization. We believe that when government officials violate our rights, they need to be held accountable. Just like when people violate the law, they're held accountable by our court system. We feel the same should apply to government officials who are in positions of authority over prisons and jails.
Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish?
Just that policies like this are somewhat popular, restricting the rights of prisoners, or in this case, pretrial detainees, who again have not necessarily been convicted of any crime yet. They're waiting to go to trial, simply because it's easy to basically beat up on people who have no political voice, who have no power, who are vulnerable because they're incarcerated. But I think the case really goes to the heart of our justice system, which is justice is supposed to be impartial. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter whether you're a rich man, a poor man, in jail or outside of jail. The same rights, in this case, rights under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, apply equally to everyone. And when you violate the First Amendment rights of people, such as happened in Columbus County with their postcard-only policy, they will be held accountable.
That was KABU's Evan Owen Stively speaking with Alex Friedman.
A write-in campaign has been launched in the Salem-Keizer School Board election on May 21st. Denise Quinn Nanke wants voters to write her in against incumbent board chair Nancy McMorris Adix, who has served on the board for 5 years. Quinn Nanke wants her objective in the, or rather she says her objective in the election is to end a federal teen outreach program in two area schools that promotes sexual health. Courses in the program are taught by district teachers and facilitated by Planned Parenthood. The research-based curriculum has been proven to reduce teen pregnancy and increase graduation rates. Also today, President Obama spoke to an audience of abortion rights proponents, recognizing that Planned Parenthood is under attack. Obama promised to continue to advocate for Planned Parenthood and its life-saving cancer screenings and other services.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales delivered his State of the City address today. The speech, delivered today during the lunch hour, focused on budget cuts, but also made mention of issues impacting the homeless, gun laws, and mandatory minimum prison sentences. During and after the speech, the Portland Mercury released details on their blog and Twitter feed regarding the proposed budget cuts and other issues mentioned during the mayor's address. Due to increasing revenue and growing costs, the city's budget has dropped by nearly $13 million this year, according to the Oregonian newspaper. In response to concerns from worried parents about the Portland schools' budget cuts, Hales said he plans to collaborate with mayors around the state to lobby Salem for a, quote, robust education budget, end quote. Hales also addressed issues pertaining to the homeless community. In response to a question about the high number of homeless people living on Portland streets, Hales replied with one word, quote, unacceptable, end quote. Repeating a message from the Portland Business Alliance, the mayor said the number of people living on the streets is an economic and livability problem. Hales made a promise that he would give this issue additional attention after the budget was finalized. When asked about Measure 11, the mayor said that he would work with other jurisdictions to reduce prison sentences.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, Wendy Sample, an advocate dedicated to improving the lives of people living with mental illness. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, perfect. Mostly sunny with a high near 70.
It's 5:19, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Ebenezer Scrooge, the Dickens character, perfectly personified the nasty rich. For example, when asked to make a charitable donation for people trapped in poverty, Scrooge curled his lip in contempt and snarled, "Are there no prisons?" Blessedly, our American society has progressed well past such heartless disdain. Unless, of course, you happen to be poor in Ohio or Georgia, or in the nationwide utopia envisioned by Newt Gingrich. Ohio's Civil Liberties Union recently issued a report documenting the Scroogean return of debtors' prisons, finding that municipal courts there are jailing poor people unable to pay court fines. Last summer, a suburban Cleveland court threw 45 people in jail because they couldn't come up with the money for fines they were assessed. And the Sandusky Municipal Court imprisoned 75 down-and-outers for the same, quote, crime. Besides the fact that jailing indigents for debts costs way more than the fines they owe, it also violates the U.S. and Ohio constitutions. But what the hey, on to Georgia, which has enhanced the debtor prison experience by privatizing it. Say you roll through a stop sign. Uniquely, the Peachtree State counts that as a criminal offense. Now, say you can't pony up for the full fine. Suddenly, you're in the clutches of a for-profit private probation corporation. It charges probationers a $15 startup fee, a $25 photo fee, and a myriad of other fees on top of the fine they owe. Fail to pay? Go to jail. Where did this rip-off system come from? A private probation outfit bribed the head of Georgia's Board of Pardons to get it passed. This is Jim Hightower saying, don't forget Newt. Gingrich says America needs to bring back workhouses for welfare children. Neat, huh? Let's criminalize poverty. Scrooge lives.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The amendment process for a bill that protects consumers from debt buyers concluded earlier this week. Another public hearing should be scheduled sometime in May. Under House Bill 2826, bill collectors are required to produce actual evidence in court before garnishing wages or bank accounts. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Economic Fairness Oregon's Executive Director Angela Martin about the status of the legislation and some of the industry practices that inspired its creation.
House Bill 2826?
Yes.
What does it do?
House Bill 2826 addresses a new industry out there called debt buying. There's mounting evidence that big banks have found another way to hide their shoddy record keeping and continue collection efforts even if evidence of the debt is weak or no longer exists. And they do this by offloading stale credit card accounts to debt buyers. Debt buyers purchase old accounts for pennies on the dollar, then aggressively seek collection of the full face value, often by filing lawsuits. And that's where the problems begin. In Oregon last year, we saw 30,000 people being sued by debt buyers.
Robo-signing once again applies as it did in the mortgage meltdown?
This is robo-signing 2.0. Robo-signing is when you have an affidavit, a sworn document to the court, attesting to some basic facts. Well, in too many of these affidavits, evidence is mounting that they're essentially just making the information up. They're not analyzing the underlying documentation before submitting a sworn statement to the court about the facts of the debt. These affidavits are then turned into judgments, and with that judgment, people's wages are garnished, their bank accounts are garnished, money is taken out of their pockets. This is a shameful abuse of our legal system, and it really does need to be addressed by requiring debt buyers to provide basic evidence of the facts of their case. Before filing a lawsuit against an Oregonian, they need to prove to the court that they have information about the amount owed, who owes it, and what the statute of limitations is. We had a very robust public hearing the end of March. House Bill 2826 has since been moved to the House Rules, and I expect we will see another public hearing within the next few weeks. The last time you ran a news segment, we received phone calls from people who were brave enough to say they've had this experience. They were sued by Portfolio Recovery or Midland or LVNV, companies they've never heard of, all of a sudden suing them on perhaps an old credit card debt they've already paid off. So folks who believe that our courts should be preserved, the legal idea of innocent until proven guilty should stand, need to stand up in support of House Bill 2826.
Is there any organizational effort to oppose this bill?
The opponents of this bill are the debt collection industry. The debt buyer industry has hired contract lobbyists to help defeat this bill.
What does this cost our judicial system?
Certainly, this is a burden on our courts. This is a burden on individuals who have to go back to court to unwind a judgment. We met with a gentleman who didn't know he had been sued until the garnishment came. He had to go hire an attorney and unwind that lawsuit. It took time, money, and a lot of emotional stress to stop what never should have taken place to begin with. And that was an unlawful suit. He was never even given notice that he was being sued. And yet, all of a sudden, his wages are being garnished. This has gone a step too far, and House Bill 2826 is a way to bring some reasonable standards of evidence back to our legal system.
So can you tell me what does the rest of the path for this bill look like?
We still need to see a vote on the House floor before it moves to the Senate for the same process. As always, consumer protection issues are an uphill battle because we are up against some very large moneyed interests. But I have faith that there are a lot more consumers out there who have reached the end of their rope. It is simply unfair that banks and debt buyers should be allowed to sue people without evidence.
That was Robin Ryan speaking with Economic Fairness Oregon's Executive Director Angela Martin. A bill to legalize same-sex marriage in Rhode Island passed the state Senate on Wednesday. It's expected to become law after a procedural vote next week. With the bill's passage, Rhode Island will join 9 states, including the rest of New England, as well as 3 Native American tribes and the District of Columbia, in embracing full marriage rights for same-sex couples. Efforts for marriage equality have traditionally stalled in heavily Catholic Rhode Island, failing every year since 1997. In 2011, the legislation didn't reach a vote in the General Assembly. This year, the bill passed 51-19 in the House and 26-12 in the Senate. Supporters ascribe their success to a broad coalition approach, which brought together the AFL-CIO, environmental groups, Governor Lincoln Chafee, and Providence Mayor Angela Tavares. Opponents also identified a shift in media representations of same-sex couples as a factor in legislation.
As rescue operations were underway at the collapsed Rana Plaza in Bangladesh on Friday, clashes with police erupted elsewhere in the city of Dhaka, where thousands of garment workers protested in the streets. The rescue effort, largely aided by volunteers, was able to save 100 people on Friday. This brings the total number of people rescued to 2,300. Families of the factory workers clashed with police, causing a two-hour delay. Thousands of garment workers held demonstrations in Dhaka, smashing vehicles and setting fire to at least two factories. Bowing to popular demand, Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina ordered the arrest of Sohail Rana, the owner of the building, and the owners of the four garment factories. In recent months, Bangladesh has been hit by political turmoil, with elections coming up this year. Instability is likely to continue in the country. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kristen Yount, Joe Meyer, Theo Burke, Robin Ryan, Evan Owen Stively, Rachel Bennett, and Sahir Homanish, and Tony Imus. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. The KBOO Foundation Board of Directors has posted the following special meeting notice. The KBOO Foundation hereby notifies the general membership of a special membership meeting to be held at Tabor Space at 1 p.m. on May 4, 2013, for the stated purpose of holding a discussion regarding the current changes occurring at KBOO. That's Saturday, May 4, 2013, at 1 p.m. at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland, Oregon, for a discussion of the current changes at KBOO. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey host a discussion of a recent article titled Why People React Differently to Panhandlers. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, with social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus, a weekly interview show about our place on the planet. And at 11 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall moderates a discussion on mental illness, first with three members of a local chapter of National Alliance for Mental Illness, and then with psychiatrist Dr. Jim Phelps. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight on Bread and Roses, Wendy Sample, an advocate dedicated to improving the lives of people living with mental illness. Have a great weekend. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the KBOO Evening News every Monday through Friday, right here on KBOO at 5 p.m. And the KBOO Evening News was made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. Finish up the news with Counterspin, 6 o'clock, Bread and Roses, right here on KBOO.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Boston bombings were labeled as terrorist attacks almost from the start. But what does that label mean? And how is it used? We'll talk to Cal State University at Chico professor Bo Grosskopf about how the term is used and perhaps misused. Also on Counterspin today, much of the town of West Texas was destroyed in an explosion at the West Fertilizer plant on April 18th. Why was there 270 tons of explosive ammonium nitrate in a plant nestled among homes and schools? Because criminal laws were broken, says famed EPA whistleblower Hugh Kaufman, who will join us to critique media portrayals of the disaster as merely a matter of regulatory oversight. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
When you think of George W. Bush, you might think about an aggressive and illegal war that resulted in the deaths of perhaps a million people. Torture and secret prisons, domestic spying, cutting taxes for the rich while slashing veterans' health care, or maybe the whole stealing that election thing. Those who harbor such thoughts will need to hang on tight to ride what looks like it will be a wave of coverage seeking to rehabilitate Bush around the dedication of his presidential library at Southern Methodist University. The Washington Post's Dan Balls suggested that the library would trigger debate over Bush's record. But if most reporting looks like his April 23rd piece, a roundup of quotes overwhelmingly from Bush friends and associates,